term here, so I'm going to be posting your very last worksheet.
How exciting. And we're going to be, I'll be posting whatever kind of last, you know, practice problems and ways to reach me up until the exam. And if I can try and work it in, because you guys are such an early exam for CivPro, I'll do an extra review session or find some medium by which to do it. In past years, I've had students even do, there's like an instant messaging piece of TWNs. We can do it off-site, whatever you want. Just let me know what you prefer, and we can figure something out. So kind of be on the lookout for those things. If you're having any issues, make sure to see me. My last tip, I've talked to a lot of students about the midterm, since you're just, you know, focusing on the material from the midterm on, that I've really tried, after seeing the midterm, to make the worksheets a little bit more like nuts and bolts from the very beginning to the end. That really is your outline in a lot of ways. So you don't really need to, you know, be working so much aside from that or creating extra work for yourself. I tell you, the best thing you can do for yourself right now is take any of the questions in the PowerPoints, because as you remember from the midterm, a lot of my questions are literally discrete issues, and write out answers. Because it's one thing to know what an answer is and a very different thing to be able to articulate it. And so that's that section on TWN that I gave you to post. And I've got a couple from students either individually or on the TWN site, and I'll be getting those back this weekend of everything I've got posted up till now, and then try and get them as quickly as I can back to you, because I know you're studying. Yeah.
You said we can do that up until the last class next Friday.
Yeah, up to Friday is when you can post ones for me to review. But you can always write them, you know, and that's something I would suggest exchanging with your study groups. It's very helpful. If other people can't see, like, where the rule comes and when you're applying facts to the rule, then that probably means I can't. But that is by far and away, even if you're at the end, and I know you're time-sensitive with every single task you're doing, the most important thing you should do for all of your classes. Because in the end, we're not going to ask you to turn in your outline and say, that looks great. It's going to be, can you write an essay answer? All right, so I know, I've been there. You get down in the end, you're trying to finish everything. That's where you should put your time. Okay. That's my last little soapbox moment. Let's get back to CivPro. All right, so we're talking about Celotex and summary judgment, and we left off with the options the movement has, and we said reckless, for example, when he's not the person carrying the burden at trial, his options can include introducing evidence to show why we can't show breach. One other thing he can do is basically say, Parsons, you have to carry the burden at trial, and we've looked at what you've been able to develop through discovery, and there isn't enough here, so you should give me judgment now. And that's really the second option. We've showed all the theoretical options. I just wanted you to review these again, because we're going to talk about it from Parsons' perspective. Sort of the dicta in Celotex is not the holding, but we can apply it here. We said it's not just simply asserting in the motion that you can't prove it. It's rather that you actually have to do discovery and then point out in the vacancies in the discovery why they're not going to be able to show it. So for breach, every person who's been a witness to the scene has suggested I drove well. That's what it would look like. You know, look at, you know, Jeff was on the side of the street and saw it. He said, I didn't change lanes. I was going at a normal speed. You know, and then this person, and then that person. Either they didn't see it well, or they said I was doing what I should be doing. Okay? That's what he needs to do. That's what he needs to do. The third option would be that he'd actually have to prove the negative, that he was not the cause, and we said that that, in fact, were not breach, that, in fact, is not required. But what if we flip the story and make it that it's Parsons who's moving? We're still on the move-ins burden, but let's say it's Parsons who's moving for summary judgment on her claim. We are going to move for summary judgment. Can we simply do what Parsons had to, I mean, what Reckless had to do, like number two? Can we just have this holding that we just point to something in discovery and prevail if we're going to move for summary judgment? Does that seem appropriate? What do you think? What's our option? If we want to move for summary judgment on negligence, can we just simply say he's not going to be able to do something? Yeah.
No, you have to point out that you can actually win your case and you're entitled to judgment, so you have to prove all the elements.
Okay, so if we were to say, looking back at those options, if we were to rephrase them and not be a defendant kind of phrasing, what option is a plaintiff, if they're moving for summary judgment, what option do they have to do? What do you think?
They have to prove the third one, like the most burdensome.
The most exacting, because why? Why? Because at trial, they have to bear the burden of proof. Remember? It's their prima facie case. Defendant doesn't have a burden of proof, so defendant can get away with a little less. They can just say the person who's supposed to carry the day can't. But since we have to carry the day, and summary judgment says there's no disputes, no genuine disputes of material fact, and I'm entitled to judgment as a matter of law, you have to come up with enough evidence to say this is negligent. It proves it. So you can't do as little as the defendant can. So in the end of the day, how do you put down in your notes what Celotex stands for? Well, for movement's burdens, the person moving for summary judgment, if you don't bear the burden of proof at trial, you're the defendant. Then you have that option two as you're holding, that you must do something more than just rest on your answer and rest on the complaint. You have to do discovery and point out where the lack of evidence is going to be for the plaintiff. And if you're the plaintiff, you bear the burden of proof at trial, you actually have to show you're entitled to relief, which means you actually have to have evidence of your elements. You have to prove your claim. And that makes sense, because we wouldn't want summary judgment to be a way to get around what you would have to do as a plaintiff. You know? What part do you need me to repeat? It's like a 3-minute discussion.
Sorry. What? If you're the movement, you have to.
Well, it depends on who is the movement. If you don't bear the burden at trial, you're Celotex. You're the defendant. You have to just do number two, which is just point out where in the case there's a lack of evidence supporting the plaintiff's case. If you're the plaintiff, it's option three, which is you have to prove your case with all of its elements. All right? So it looks at who's moving for summary judgment and do they bear the ultimate burden at trial. Okay. So could she do something without affidavits or is she going to need an affidavit? Do we need an affidavit if we're going to move for summary judgment? What do you think? Is it required? You have to have an affidavit, or could you do something else besides an affidavit? Look back at the rule. What does it require? Does it require an affidavit if you're the plaintiff? Shaking your head? Yeah, now you're right. That's right. That's where I'm going, because I'm like, that's the right head shake. All right, so what could you do instead besides just using affidavits? That's right. So you could use the rest of discovery. Use discovery to prove your claim. Now, what would that look like? What would that look like? I mean, we keep talking about the rules. I just want to make sure you understand what this actually is in practice. An affidavit is her testifying, basically, by swearing in written form before a notary public to say what she's going to say she would testify to, and it's true. Other aspects of what you would look to discovery to use your claim would be like looking to depositions, answers to interrogatories, admissions, requests for admissions, whatever was actually admitted, and saying in their request for admission they admitted the following. In the answer to the interrogatory they said this. In the deposition, the officer stated this is what he saw. Okay, and all those things together prove that he was negligent, I was free of negligence, it was the cause of my damage. All right. Any questions on that at all? Okay, so that's the movement's burden. Let's think about it from the non-movement's perspective for a moment. Now, this isn't in Celotex necessarily, but I think you can glean it from that and then the rule itself. So make sure you have 56 out. We're just recalling the initial hypothetical. Reckless moves for summary judgment on the claim. He argues Parsons cannot prove breach because he was driving with all reasonable care and found 10 witnesses that verify his version of the story. And remember, we have that police officer report. Okay? So one thing is, can we just oppose his motion by simply saying, look at our complaint, we've already alleged he was negligent?
That's absolutely not allowed, okay? That was Celotex. Celotex was for the defendant and about the movement's burden, but it also has in dicta statements about the non-movement. If you look at page 752, it says that the non-movement can do a variety of things under the rule. It's the very top of 752, that last sentence in that first paragraph. Rule 56, and then remember, it's now codified in a different section. It's now C1A,
permits a proper summary judgment motion to be opposed by any of the kinds of evidence and materials listed in the rule, except the mere pleadings themselves. Now, does that mean you never look at the pleadings? No. The judge often does to figure out what the argument really is here, what the claim that they're purporting to actually prove is, but you can't rest on it because it's just a mere statement. Summary judgment is about using your discovery, actually looking at what's going to be proved at trial when it's been rendered in something that could potentially be admissible. All right, let's assume that, okay, so what we should do, so with the affidavit of the police officer, right, that'd be one way to do it. Let's assume, however, she's unable to obtain the affidavit of the police officer because he's on assignment out of the country for 2 months. Consider the options here. What should she do? Should she file a motion for extension of time? B, submit an affidavit stating the reasons for her inability to secure the officer's affidavit. C, subpoena the police officer. D, A and B, E, all of the above. In your worksheet, I just asked you to describe steps. I'm just putting in a multiple choice question. So, what do you think is the best description of what she should do? We know we can't just rely on her complaint. This is the person who helped us out to oppose summary judgment. What do? Okay, if you haven't already, please click in. All right, so we've got A, and we've got B, or B and D, which includes A and B. And I think the appropriate answer under the rule is actually B. Now, for people who got A, I think what you're thinking is, well, I can't just go to the court without something and it's true, so you're likely to have some kind of motion, but it's not a motion for extension of time. It would just literally be a motion under Rule 56 for this, if you wanted to do that. The rule doesn't actually even require that you actually move, but that's technically how you typically do it. So I'm less concerned. It was just a tricky question. But clearly to the rule, it's B. It's submit an affidavit stating the reasons for inability to secure the officer's affidavit. It's not, however, because we've got some people on E, all of the above, because you wouldn't subpoena the police officer. So the best answer is B, because the rule tells us what we do is we go to the court with our affidavit stating the reasons for inability to secure the officer's affidavit. You have to identify why you're unable to come up with the evidence to withstand the motion for summary judgment if you're the non-movement. And what you should see is the rule actually, if this is new to the rule, what they're trying to do is create some ability to give more reason to allow someone to oppose a summary judgment motion. It's kind of more reflective of we don't want things automatically given summary judgment. And so the advisory committee who proposed these were trying to add in more steps to actually codify that. What they saw was courts were doing this without any actual process on the books. So they wrote process to permit this. But you don't actually technically have to have anything like this, and this actually doesn't exist. I just made it up. All right. So the subpoena for the police officer, if you were thinking about something like this, you could do that through discovery. And so what you would do is, under the rule, you do this affidavit and then ask the court for additional discovery opportunities. I'm assuming, though, since he's out of the country, the subpoena power would not help you, which is kind of why you're in the trouble you're in. So what could the court actually do if we give them this affidavit? What's their options? What does 56D permit them to do? Mr. Iweller, what does it permit them to do?
I don't have the rule language in front of me, but they can, I think they decide whether or not to give you more time.
Okay, one thing they can do is defer the motion, and so that's sort of the idea of more time. In other words, we're not going to rule right now. We'll give you some time to do it. It also says in the rule, allow for more discovery, because one reason you would do deferment is to permit discovery. If we could say he's coming back into the country, I can acquire his affidavit at that point in time, or he'll be within the subpoena power of the court at that time, but that's what I'll end up doing. What else does it allow you to do? Yeah.
The court can defer considering the motion or deny it.
Okay, they can also deny the motion, which means basically we're just not going to even worry about you getting these other pieces. We don't think they're going to be able to actually prove a summary judgment motion. Because realize it's the non-movement who's asking this, and you're saying you get the best answer, which is just outright deny the motion. Okay, and that's for courts who really want to allow this to get to the jury. When would this happen? Well, typically when you look at what's been presented by the person moving for summary judgment and it looks somehow insufficient. And so we can say, look, I could go get this guy's statement, but look at what they have anyway. Just deny this motion. That's what that kind of thing looks like. One other aspect is the catch-all, any other order, and that's just to give the court as much leniency to permit the most equitable result. But you have to move specifically under this rule with an affidavit to specifically mention why you can't get it. You can't just say, hey, I need more time, which is why he's gone. Okay? Good. All right. Last little kind of cleanup parts of the rule, affidavits and then court powers that are not already discussed in the other aspects. What is an affidavit, Mr. Eiweller? What's an affidavit?
That's a formal sworn statement of fact.
Okay, good. It's a formal sworn statement of fact, taking it under oath. What's the difference between that and a declaration then? Because the rule keeps saying affidavits or declarations, affidavits or declarations. Do you know? Does anyone know what the difference between an affidavit and a declaration is?
Is it an affidavit written down?
Mm-mm, they're both written. Do you raise your hand? Okay. Yeah.
It's not a declaration. It's not under oath.
It is under oath. All right, so you see a word in a rule. Where are you going to go to figure out what it means? Not Google. You have people who, like, I love, like, people, every year when I get papers of students, I have people send me Wikipedia, I'm like, for real? But actually, you know, it's not really a source, it's like, you know, your grandma being like, I think an affidavit's blah, blah, blah. So, okay, not Google, but where else could you go? In Google, you could find something, which would be a much better source than just Google itself, which is the world of who has internet connection. What could you Google? What could you go find? That's probably the reference I'd want to check, Black's Law Dictionary. And since I know you have internet connection, what is it? Yes.
Voluntary declaration of facts written down sworn by the secretary or an officer authorized to administer oaths.
Okay, and what's the difference though between that and an affidavit?
Nothing.
No, there is.
There's no
process
information.
Not always even an affidavit that you have that either or in a declaration, so it's not always hinging on that. There's something else. It's about who you're actually giving your sworn statement. Yeah, it's the notary that you have in the affidavit. And a declaration is everything but the notary, so it's actually easier to get. So the rule was amended to include declarations, and I'll tell you actually a lot of people are already doing that. So it's still sworn under oath. You wouldn't want to, you know, give a declaration to the court without being certain of its veracity. And in fact, the rule actually just takes affidavits or declarations through every single subsection. They're referenced simultaneously for that reason. The same penalty of filing a false one or a bad one is there. So whenever you see a rule or a word you don't know, first thing actually you should do is, before you go to Black's Law, is where? The rule itself. And the rule doesn't define it because they're thinking like legal common language. So it's Black's Law. All right. And I know you have that available to you right now. So, do you have to have these? I already mentioned before, no, they're not required. But what should they look like? Here, let's go ahead and click on this one. What should an affidavit be like under 56C4? Must be based on personal knowledge, set out in facts that would be admissible as evidence, show a fiat is competent to testify, D, all of the above, A, B, and C, or E, only A and B.
All
right, go ahead and click it if you haven't already. Okay, good. Everyone has this one? Okay, we got a little squirrely, so I knew we must really know this one. All right, that's correct. Okay, but the question for you really is not just, like, reading the rule, but figuring out why would they require so much? I mean, think about it. Is that a small list of things you need to be able to create an affidavit? It's a pretty stringent rule. It has to be based on personal knowledge. It has to set up facts that would be admissible as evidence. It has to show that you're competent to testify. Let's think about it. Personal knowledge, what does that mean?
You actually witnessed the event or was it hearsay?
In some way, you are actually a witness to it or to some aspect of it. All right, so do we always depose people who have, like, personal knowledge at that level, that they were a fact kind of witness? No. A lot of times we depose people who might lead us to other things. So you're actually looking for the people who could say, I saw the accident. And it has to be something that's admissible as evidence. So one thing you discussed already that might not be admissible is hearsay, and you'll spend weeks and weeks discussing that in evidence. We're not talking about it now. But things that are out of court statements, generically, you can't put in. It has to show that you're competent to testify. So what are these things trying to get at? Why have so many requirements? I have so many requirements. What are these requirements getting at? If you look at them together. Yeah?
This is kind of what we go before a jury. And so because we're not using a jury, we want to know exactly what's going on in the court and all the information they can see.
Right. We can only consider information the jury could. And so, because we're taking this away from them, saying there's no need for them. So we wouldn't want to say, based on hearsay, you should get summary judgment. Because we know if we went to court, you wouldn't be able to use that. Or based on the statements of someone who's completely incompetent to testify. Well, that wouldn't be fair at trial. Why is it fair for the judge to give you judgment on it? So for each of these, we're trying to make it as closely mirroring what you'd see at trial. And so that's why there's so many limitations on it. If you file one of these in bad faith or for the purpose to delay, meaning like you file an affidavit stating something that wasn't truly a fact, like the witness who says, yes, reckless was swerving crazily, and you know when you depose this individual, they said, well, I had my back turned in the accident, but I heard this big crash and spun around. And if they file an affidavit saying, I'm swerving like a madman, you know that that's not true. So that's either in bad faith or for the purpose of delay. I don't want to lose on summary judgment. I want to get more time. Maybe I'll find someone else better. Is that okay? Well, obviously, no. Bad faith and purpose to delay is never one of those things like, yeah, go ahead. I'm sure it'll be fine. All right, so what happens to you under H? How bad is this under H? What may happen to you? Yeah.
In order, you pay expenses incurred by the other party based on this affidavit.
Okay, and so what would that mean, expenses based on this affidavit?
And the cost of the lawyer's time and anyone that didn't pay for, like, to research the claims.
Okay, so now maybe we sent someone to go talk to this individual, interviewing them. Maybe gathering more evidence, overcome it in summary judgment, all that time that we would use to defend it. Is it everything you've done through trial, all your fees so far? No, it's those related to it. And realize it's a may to pay the attorney's fees to the other side. And it only is after notice and an opportunity to respond. Because we don't just say, oh, we assume this is on bad faith. You get to show why you felt like it wasn't in bad faith or wasn't for the purpose of delay. One other big thing can happen to you. It's actually even worse than fees. What's that? Beyond sanction. What particular kind of sanction?
Contempt
of court, yeah. And as an officer of the court, that's not a good thing. All right, so realize you're submitting these, you're on the hook. It's not just the affiant. All right. All right. Because realize it says if submitted, which means you, even not as the declarant, you need held in contempt of court. All right. Okay, so let's talk a little bit then about what the judge does. In ruling on a summary judgment motion, the court considers what are the following. This is from yours.
from your worksheet. Basically, affidavits, deposition testimony, admissions, or requests for admissions, materials in the record not even cited by the parties, their motion papers are all considered. Allegations of the pleadings are not enough alone. It doesn't mean that they can't look at allegations in the pleadings, you know, to know the framing of what the suit's about, but it's not enough. That's solid text. The one other thing to point out is where in the rule do you see these things? Where do you see affidavits, deposition, testimony, and admissions? Where do you see those things coming in? I'm hearing lots of 56. That's really hard to follow. So someone want to... Yeah.
C1A.
Yeah, C1A. It's all that stuff. Remember, you get the right to show by putting all these things specifically assigned to in the record. That's where, what the court's looking to. What about the last one? Materials in the record not cited by the parties in their motion papers. How could they do that? Seems a little ultra virus. The court just kind of is going off rogue. But they can. Yeah, Scrum.
It feels like justice will be served by them doing that for God. And they still go to the record.
And where is that in our rule? 56C3. Yeah, 56C3 says this. It specifically gives the court power to do that. Now, some courts were doing this. Again, this is a new codification. This is a new piece of the rule. They were giving license to it. So you're seeing kind of tensions. The last one was for people who don't want to get summary judgment and get more time. This one is for the courts that love summary judgment because we're going to say, you know what? He did a bad job of giving record evidence, but I'm looking at it and I see it right here. And having worked for courts and weeded through records, writing these opinions on these things, I'll tell you a lot of times when you're reading deposition testimony, you're like, why didn't they cite the disputes? And before we would just write on it, but now the rules committee is giving us explicit authority to do so. Because sometimes the lawyering isn't so great. We're like, look, it's right there, three lines up. That's where they actually say what you're trying to get them to say. Okay? All right. Next piece. Here's your hypos, and I just put the rule on top. Let's flesh out the last little bit of the rule that I want you to focus on, which is E. And this is, again, a new section of the rule. It's kind of, again, not drafted the best, and I'll tell you why that I think number three is actually a little off. If you read the advisory committee notes when they made this rule, they think it means two things, one of which I don't think is really there. So we'll talk about what they think it means. But for the basics, just on the language itself, let's look at these hypos. Reckless files his summary judgment motion. Persons failing to understand what Rule 56C requires. Simply files a brief in opposition. Fails to cite any evidence in the voluminous record, but simply argues many people said he swerved. We would never do that, right? Which subsection permits the court to give persons the chance to check the record and cite any evidence in the record supporting her theory. So instead of having to click on these, can you just tell me, Mr. Clark, what do you think? Which part of the E or 56E that I have here would allow them to do this? To give persons a chance to check the record and cite any evidence in the record supporting her theory. Sorry, what?
56E1.
Yeah, the first one. And that's it. Give an opportunity to properly support or address the fact. This is a hypothetical that's just trying to demonstrate what that rule was designed to do. That it allows for people who haven't quite done what we wanted them to do, the court to give them an opportunity to do so. All right. If you look at the next one, same rule. Here's another hypo. Reckless's summary judgment motion points to the testimony of 100 witnesses who agree that persons swerved into him or skated into him. In opposition, persons introduced the affidavit of one police officer who states that he did not see the accident, but when he arrived, he heard another person say that Reckless had swerved. What subsection, the first question, permits the court to hold that it's undisputed that Reckless did not swerve? Mr. Wilson, what do you think?
E2.
Yeah, E2. What about then to hold that he's entitled to summary judgment?
That
would be under 3. Yeah. So that's kind of a combination. 2 and 3 oftentimes work together. It's a combination of if you really can't step up to the plate and giving me more time and whatever other opportunities for discovery is not going to fix this problem, our other remedy is just to say there is no dispute then, because otherwise you would have come forward with something to dispute this fact. So this explicitly now gives us the right to say you hold it undisputed. Now, there was a lot of cases out there that use this language, but the rule hadn't actually
said it as such. Now it does. And the third, grant summary judgment if the motion supporting materials, including any facts under 2 that we've considered undisputed, show that the movement is entitled to it. All right, so I think that's the basics of what this shows. The Rules Advisory Committee also has another purpose for 3. And they said in every case, the court goes to its power under 56E3. Why? They think E3 holds the standard again and reminds the court that that's what they're looking at. Which is sort of duh, because that's what 56A says. But hey, now we have an extra rule. All right, so that's just saying, remember, you are looking for no genuine issues of material facts such that you're entitled to judgment as a matter of law to show that the movement is entitled to it. So it's, again, just re-codifying that. All right. That's basically the last bits of the rules. Any questions on 56E or its operation? It's not as tricky, I think, as the standard of the process, but. And of course, you get a catch-all. Okay, so the last parting final thought before we do our hypos to review. What happens to a case if the court denies summary judgment? Well, we know what happens if they grant it, right? The case is now finished on the merits if we grant summary judgment, or at least the claim that we've moved for summary judgment on, or the defense we've moved for summary judgment on. But what happens if it's denied?
You have the opportunity to settle
under the trial. You go to trial. Yeah, so for litigation purposes, you're going to trial. And always, settlement is on our minds. And then truthfully, what typically happens is settlement at this time. Unless you're really like, wow, we've got an awesome dispute here and I think we might win. In which case, you shouldn't settle. Go to trial. Okay. All right, so let's go through our hypos that we had. There's some of them earlier in the worksheet, and then we're going to do 9.1. So it's just a good review of everything we've learned. Now, I want to refresh your recollection from the top to the bottom. Summary judgment, no genuine dispute of material fact, and that you're entitled to judgment as a matter of law. And then the process is the movement has to show through record citation that there's no genuine dispute of material fact, and that they're entitled to judgment as a matter of law. The opponent can show or point out lack of creation of a dispute or lack of dispute and also put evidence on their own. So let's just see how it works out. We're still using auto accidents because it's just easy to think about. But we're changing it up a bit and making it red light, green light, because that's also easy to think about. All right, so we've got an auto accident at an intersection. The parties are suing in a traditional contributory negligence jurisdiction, which means that the plaintiff's claim will be barred if he is at all at fault. And so the defendant's theory now is that the plaintiff ran the red light and that the plaintiff's claim should be barred. So they're trying to deflect any question about their own negligence, saying, hey, if he was at all negligent, he doesn't get anything. So would summary judgment be appropriate if the defendant moves for summary judgment with the submission of an affidavit of witness who says, I saw the light was red. Plaintiff responds by pointing to his complaint, which he said the light was green. Okay, summary judgment appropriate. A, yes. B, no. And I'm going to set a timer because we've had these for a while. So go ahead and click on in. And then what I want you to do now is see that any of these could be turned into an essay question for you to answer. That's what they are. So we'll talk about how you answer it. Summary judgment appropriate, yes or no? I'm sorry? Yes, I did. I don't know where it's at. Where did you guys get the tenant sheet passing around already?
Yeah.
Yep. Someone want to wave or they have the tenant sheet at? Okay, we're splitting 50-50, so that's not so great. But anywhere, because we have that over there. We have the tenant sheet. Who has the attendance sheet right now? There you go. He's just enthralled by lecture, and I think that's good. Back to CivPro. Okay. So we've got like a 40-60 split on whether or not summary judgment should be appropriate. So let's talk about whether or not summary judgment should be granted. Okay. In this hypothetical, we need to show... Here, I'll close this up. We need to show, the defendant needs to show that there's no genuine issue of material fact and that they're entitled to judgment as a matter of law. And to oppose summary judgment, the plaintiff needs to either make a genuine dispute of material fact or show that defendant's not entitled to judgment as a matter of law.
All right, so someone, since you're basically 50-50, half the class is with you, does someone want to take a stab at describing what they think this one is? Yeah?
There's a genuine dispute of the fact, because one's saying that the light was red and one's saying that the light was green, and so...
Okay, so we have a genuine dispute, because one is saying red and one's saying green. Yeah?
Plaintiff can't point to pleading.
Okay, but it's not. Well, it's actually it's not supported well through the process, because what you have to do to demonstrate it is by specifically citing something to the record. And so here, in actuality, the genuineness, you could say, is actually not proved, because there isn't something a reasonable fact finder could hang their hat on. As far as the standard goes, we are seeing something that's in dispute, but it's not been properly supported. So does that make sense? So the way I would describe it is two ways. It's not really genuine, because there's nothing to support the evidence. But even more clearly, I'd point to this as a feeling of 56C, C1A. Yeah.
So the plaintiff, would this not be summary judgment that is plaintiff filed a joint affidavit?
Okay, well, I think we're going to get to that in just a second. You look at the hypos. Hold on. But you're right, in the end, yes. That's okay. It just shows that you're thinking right along the exact same track I was, which is the right track to go down. So don't worry about it. But in this one, do you see what the defect is? This one's tricky, but it's a good kind of sample of what an examination question would be like. Because I want you to understand, it is about a material issue. They're trying to put it into genuine dispute, but the dispute isn't genuine because there isn't support behind what the plaintiff is saying. It's a failing of the process. Does everyone understand how you'd write it? You understand how you write it? Okay. Any questions? Yes?
So if we see what Bonham and Gio, could we talk about 56E? Because I think, isn't this the situation where the court has discretion to give the plaintiff more time to fix the problem?
If you had time to respond and include that in there, you could include one line in that. I think facts that would trigger that were more like the ones I gave you, where it's like we've identified something or identified a problem where we want some assistance typically. The court is always free to commit more time, but you'd have to wonder why they haven't done anything more than just restate their allegation. But yeah, I think as far as an answer goes, though, that would be the last thing I would put in, because you really want to hit to why is this not good enough first. Yeah.
Can you cite to something in pleadings, I guess, if it's admitted by both parties? So if it comes in a complaint...
Like stipulation?
It's admitted in the answer, then can you cite to that?
Yes.
Can that be a...
Yeah.
Okay.
You can never cite to anything in your complaint, though, because that's not an admission. But in the answer, if they admit to a fact, then that's admissible. It's like any kind of other admission or stipulation. Yeah. Okay. Any other ones on that? I think this is a good degree of difficulty, and you should be able to answer it. Okay, let's look at the next one. Now, he responds with an affidavit of a witness who says the light is green, okay? Is this one something where a summary judgment should be granted? A yes, B no. They could look at, but it's not alone. Okay, go ahead and if you haven't already, click in on this one. Helps me know if you're having troubles, so make sure you click in. Oh, yeah, by the way, the last answer was yes, it should have been granted. Yes, summary judgment should have been granted. Okay. We're at this one. Okay, good. This one is no. Okay, why is this one no? How would you describe it? Because, again, it's one thing to know the answer, and it's a different one to explain the answer. Yeah. Okay, so first thing you want to start with is the citation to the standard of summary judgment. That there has to be no genuine dispute of material facts. And which is this raising? Is she saying it wasn't material, or is she saying it's genuinely disputed? It's genuinely disputed. Plaintiff is arguing it's genuinely disputed because
And then you'd want to say, and have they properly supported the assertion that it's genuinely disputed? This time they have, under 56C, specifically 1A, but I want you to know the subsection at least. So 56C, why is it proper under 56C? What'd they do?
They made that proper under 56C. I'll close up the box so you can see it again. Yeah.
They cited to the affidavit of the witness.
Right, they made a showing, citing specifically to materials in the record. Here's an affidavit, that's one of the things listed. It's been properly supported, so now there's a genuine dispute over a material fact. Material, because it needs to be resolved to determine whether or not she can prevail, the plaintiff can prevail, and it's generally disputed because a reasonable jury could conclude either way. And all that would have to be in your answer, yeah.
So does the genuine piece, I guess, sit on the fact that it was procedurally done?
Genuine is whether or not a reasonable jury could conclude either way. Is it truly disputed?
Couldn't they have concluded that in the previous question? Now?
Because they couldn't have considered the allegations in their complaint. That's not evidence, and so they can't.
Because it was pleading?
Right. But I think the best way to answer it, like I think, because that's kind of what we're driving at the question, is how do you answer it? I think if you start out with the standard and identify what's material, what's needed to be resolved, then ask, is it genuine? Could a reasonable jury determine either way? When you're answering, could a jury look at it, you're thinking about the process as well. Did they properly introduce material to support or oppose the motion? And that's under 6C. Okay. Or did they, if you're opposing the motion, did they properly, like, impugn
under 56C1B what you put forward? Okay, pointing out why it's insufficient, for example. Okay, so here, what's the material fact? The color of the light. Why is it genuine? Because now a reasonable jury can conclude either way. Okay, let's look at the next one. So that one was no summary judgment. The next one, 3. Defendant moves for summary judgment and submits the affidavit of 15 witnesses who say the light was red. Plaintiff responds to the affidavit of one witness who says the light was green. Is summary judgment appropriate? Okay, go ahead and click in on this one. 20 seconds. Go ahead and click in on this one. A yes, B no. Okay. All right. Most people are saying yes for summary judgment. This one, remember in Civ Pro where I told you most things have a definite yes or no? When we get to questions where we actually do have a judgment call, there's more. And the only time I will accept a maybe answer on your exam would be something like this. But I will tell you, it's actually no is the better answer here. It's the better answer. Mm-hmm. Why? Because we're invading the role of the jury. So let's go back to, I'll give you the answer why real quick, and then we'll talk about how you write it out. Okay? So the why answer is, I think this is enough to show that the dispute is genuine, that a reasonable jury could conclude one way or the other. But I think it's probably more arguable that a really progressive judge might, in fact, grant you summary judgment on it. But just having quantity different is not enough. Remember, you're looking at the quality of the witnesses. And if you have someone who has maybe a better vantage point, you have your right to go to the jury. Okay? So, did you have a question? Were you raising your hand? Huh?
You just gave 15 to
1. Yeah, I didn't say, well, I know, but that's the thing. A quantity is not enough alone. Even if it's all people all standing in a row 15 to 1, you still, for judges who are more sensitive to the role of the jury, you would not win on summary judgment.
It really, at this point, this does come down to finesse of argument. The judge you select or get you don't get selected. The judge you pull, basically, from when you file your complaint. It's why a lot of times people argue about it's so important to pick the kind of judge I want to pick. You'll hear in public it's all about, like, the constitutional rights that rarely, if ever, come up. But I'll tell you, the people lobbying behind it is the average everyday lawyer worrying about, like, summary judgment for their client. Because their disposition in these kinds of cases actually make a difference. It really does. So the same kind of case before two different judges might come out in a different way. But I'll tell you, more tend to lean towards giving you the chance to get to the jury. Now, if we got to, like, 100-1, now it's really going to be hard to say that you should say that there should be summary judgment. But 15-1, maybe a really good lawyer and a really progressive judge, maybe. Okay, but let's talk about how you'd answer it in the exam. And again, for this one, I wouldn't be looking for yes or no. I'd be looking for the analysis. So I really wouldn't care. I want you to talk about why you think it's genuine, why you think it's material. So you'd start out, first of all, is this a material fact? I realize the rule's written, no genuine dispute of material fact. I think it's easiest to start with material, to know whether it's actually needed, and then say, is that genuinely disputed? Material fact, whether light's red or green, will dictate whether or not plaintiff can prevail at all. Because if he ran a red light and a traditional contributory negligence jurisdiction, he's out of luck. All right. So then you ask, is it genuinely disputed? And here you say, could a reasonable jury conclude one way or another? I think what you want to think about for these ones is sort of a spectrum where it's so clear that it would be unreasonable to rule any other way, then you rule in favor of the movement because there's no need for the jury. Okay? And that could be at either end of the spectrum. It could be nobody could reasonably find anything other than the light was red. Then we rule in favor of the defendant. If no one could conclude anything other than it was green, then we rule in favor of the plaintiff. But it's anywhere in the middle, and then it's a lot about argumentation and the judge and all that. Hate to confess that because I like the strictness of rules, but that's the reality. All right, what about 4? Well, 4 is kind of looking at this from a slightly different viewpoint. If you look at the same facts, however, this time the affidavit is the plaintiff's. We won't click on this one. I just want you to know the analysis. It should run about the same way that I don't think you should grant summary judgment in this situation. Although this one, I think you're even getting closer to, if it's exact same facts, 15 against you, you're, I think, even triggering more judges to say, yeah, maybe summary judgment's appropriate. Why? Is it the fact that it's you make it automatically not good enough? No. But maybe the quality is starting to go down a little bit if it's someone who's totally biased. So you might get more judges who are more willing to say summary judgment on these facts is appropriate, that it would be unreasonable to conclude any other way. But for people who are very preservative of the court, of the jury's function, they won't grant you summary judgment. All right? So that's how you answer it. That's how you practice it in real life. Any questions on that? On either part? Okay, let's look at 5, and then we're going to do 9.1. This one, I'm sorry, had a small typo. When I started drawing it out, I realized, I had it the wrong way, so I apologize. For those people who are really visual learners, this might have just irked you to no end. So here you go. Defendant moves for summary judgment and submits the affidavit of one witness who says the light was red. Plaintiff responds with the affidavit of a witness who said she did not see the light, but saw that cars coming in the other line of traffic that were going the same direction as plaintiff's car and were controlled by the same light had not stopped. So we're back to the one witness versus one witness. It's just that what they're going to be able to swear to in their affidavit is slightly different. Do you think summary judgment's appropriate? A, yes. B, no. And I'm just going to give you a short time to click in since you should already have your answer. Go work with somebody. Take 30 seconds and click on in. Summary judge or appropriate? Yes, no. What? Click it in. All right, good. Why is this one okay? She doesn't say she knows what the light is. She didn't look at the light. Why is it still okay? It says so that we should say she was able to oppose this motion for summary judgment. Why isn't this granted? You're right. This is right, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Because there's a genuine dispute and a reasonable jury could believe one person or the other.
But she doesn't know what the light actually, she didn't see it herself. Why could we use this? Like, what are we doing with this now? What's the new step? Why is this hypo here, kind of? What's different about it?
Yeah.
The fact that she is swearing to lead you to the conclusion that the light was green.
So I think we're just missing. It's not about the swearing part, but the last part of it. What is she saying?
She's basically saying that the light was green because you would determine that from the fact that all the cars were green.
Okay, good. So what this is an inference. This would be circumstantial evidence. And that is admissible in court. And a reasonable person could say, you might not have seen the light, but everyone in the world behaves in a manner that's similar to light. It's not normally green. And like, let's just take a gander at the intersection. You know, or those people get honked at, everyone tries to, you know, you would know if someone's stopping at a green light. If everybody stopped, then you can make the circumstantial inference that it's red. Yes.
Can you also say, though, that when lights change, the last couple of people drive through the intersection, and that's not proof that the light wasn't green?
That's exactly right. And where would that come up?
To me, I think it's just not material if the other cars are going, and so everyone else is negligent, big deal.
No, that would be something you'd argue to the jury and say, this is why we should reject the circumstantial inference. And you could say, look at the middle of downtown traffic in New York City, and I can guarantee you might get a jury of people to say, like, yep, that's no indication where the light's red or green. And having moved to Ohio from actually a big city, I'd be surprised. Like, that is no indication of whether or not the light is red or green, whether or not this lane is to be used for turning or driving straight or whatever, because we kind of just dope around here. So, yeah, so you could say that, but then what you're doing is trying to piece the facts and draw inferences. When you're trying to piece the facts and draw inferences, that's what the jury does, and so it suggests summary judgment's not appropriate. All right? Good? Okay. All right, let's look at Hypo 9.1. This is another good one to write out if you want. I just want to walk through it. So it's on page 760, so turn with me for a moment to that. I'm not going to reread it. I'm just going to synthesize for you what the facts were. Remember, we've got Ace, who's constructing Sally's house, suing Sally for breach of contract because he started construction. She's not paid. He says, you owe me $100,000. Now, he's got two theories. It's going to sound like for a moment we're in contracts class. But the first theory is breach of contract, that you need to prove offer plus acceptance. The second is quasi-contract, and realize someone prevailing on quasi-contract needs to prove knowledge of performance and failure to stop performance. It's sort of like an equitable doctrine, okay? And if you learn differently in contracts, just take this for CIPRO purposes right now. All right, so step back. We're going to use this as a total review, a summary judgment. Who is the movant? Who's moving for summary judgment? It's either Ace or Sally. It was Sally. Yay. Okay, so we're all there. All right, how does Sally argue she's entitled to summary judgment? Well, remember, we start with the standard, that there's no genuine dispute of material fact. And since there's two theories, she's really trying to win outright. She's got to disprove both. What was her theory on the first one? From the hypo, what was her theory? Yeah. That he didn't accept. She gave him an email. It just went out to nowhere, and she didn't hear anything. She presumed he didn't accept. There's no actual acceptance. He says quasi-contract. She says, not only did he not accept, what else? I didn't know he was working, because it was not how she was living, I just presume. Okay? So that's what she does. So she's trying to meet the standard by saying the material issue is acceptance, and the material issue is my knowledge as the person receiving this benefit. And I'm taking it out of dispute by saying, no acceptance, and I didn't know. And how does she do that? She actually submits an affidavit, okay? So if we look at the process, what does she actually do under 56C1? Which one did she do, A or B? What does she do? What does she do? Look at 56C1. What does she do? Yep. So she's under A. She's saying, citing particular facts. She did it through the form of her affidavit. All right, so here's one tricky question, though. According to Celotex, was she required to submit an affidavit, or could she have done something less? So Wilson, was she required to submit an affidavit?
No.
What could she have done? Okay, she could have given any other evidence. She could have also done something else.
One would be.
Okay, how would she do that?
She would say that what he said was not true.
that it doesn't support that there is a genuine or a dispute of material fact in any of this, and this would be under Celotex, our option two, which is looking at the discovery and pointing to absences in the record. So she actually wouldn't have to file an affidavit, since she is a movant who doesn't bear the burden at trial. It's Ace who does on the breach of contract claim. So he could just say, you're unable to prove breach of contract because looking at all this discovery, there's an absence of these things. All right. Sorry, last little bit here. Sally moves for summary judgment. We just put in what she did. She emailed an offer, but he never accepted it, and she never knew of it. How would Ace respond? You get the affidavit from Sally. What's your obligation? What would you do? What could he do? Suppose he thinks that there's a witness that will say Sally knew about the work. In fact, she's like, gosh, they're doing a great job. It looks so awesome over there. So what could he do? Now he's continuing to defend his motion, or he's going to oppose the motion. So he's under 56C. He's going to potentially, maybe under A1, or I'm sorry, C1A, going to submit the affidavit of the witness. Okay? And let's assume he assumes Sally's affidavit is submitted in bad faith because she really didn't know it. That's where we go to H for sanctions, contempt, fees. And the last one, what if he just needs more time? He wants to talk to people who knew her and could say, yes, she knew about the work. Then he could ask the court for more time by doing what? Filing an affidavit specifically listing why he couldn't get it. That's the answer to that. So that's 56D. All right, for these last ones, when I post these, I'll put the sub-rule next to it. So when you review it, you can see where it comes from. I would take 9.1. It's a great, robust question. It's right from top to bottom. Thanks. See you on Tuesday.